Do you come alive in the great outdoors? Do you love to hunt, fish, or cruise the lake every chance you get? See it all at the Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 6th and 7th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. All you could possibly want or need to gear up for outdoors with over 150 exhibitors. From apparel to hunting, fishing, boating, camping, kayaking, mountain biking, off-road utility equipment, just to name a few. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 6th and 7th at the Reading Civic Auditorium. Something for the whole family. Euro bungee, climbing wall, exhibitor demonstrations. Enjoy the beer garden with a variety of food. Win thousands in prize giveaways. $8 admission, 6 for seniors. 12 and under are free. Sunday we honor our veterans with our free admission all day. Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 6th and 7th. Go to www.readingsportsmansexpo.com for more information. Presented by Elwood Ranch, Pedigo Reading, Bridgeford, Garage Force, Crown Motors, and California Customs. See it all at the Reading Sportsman's Expo, April 6th and 7th at the Reading Civic Auditorium.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The first phase of ESG has been through moral suasion that people have been, again, suckered into the trade. Right now, it's tough to find the exit. And the problem that's coming between now and 2030 is that regulations, both here as well as in Europe in particular, are now going to cement this whole agenda into place.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Paul Tice, author of the new book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. We'll talk with Paul about his book coming up a little bit later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Miles Smith. He is Assistant Professor of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Discussing today a recent essay at the Epoch Times, Decline is a Choice. Find it at theepochtimes.com, E-P-O-C-H, times.com. So are we right to be a little concerned or focused on the potential decline of the United States?
Well, every generation of Americans confronts this question in their own way. Is there decline? There's a new book out recently that asked, did the founders think that their republic was in decline in the 1790s, right? Less than a decade after the Constitution is signed. So I think the answer is every generation has to ask this question for itself, and every generation has to commit to perpetuating constitutional freedom. So we're not alone at all in asking this question.
How have perhaps we answered this question previously or responded to this question previously?
I think that we've responded by a continual process of asking where we are going astray from our constitutional liberties. Sometimes there's correction, sometimes there's not. So there's no uniform answer that's been given. That's why we have something like, for example, the New Deal or the Great Society. So every generation answers it differently. There's no sort of pristinization of the American Republic that's gone on.
More recently, we have movements, events pushed by the left, if we want to say BLM movement or any of those. What's been the effect on social and political order, and how does it influence our understanding of decline?
Probably the most significant difference in our own time is sort of a broad-based sociocultural American self-loathing. Americans don't like their country anymore. That is new. That's something different. Usually, even historically, folks on the left would say, well, we love our country and we need to do things to make it better. Now you have sort of a proposition that maybe America was not only bad, but maybe never should have existed, or it only exists because of something like slavery or racism. And so that is new. There's an idea about that the world might be better off without America.
It's an interesting point in that the criticism is not just of America now. It is of America at its very foundations, that it was racist then. It is built on sand, that anything that we have now 200 plus years after the fact, we shouldn't have had to begin with because of the sins of our forefathers. Is that sort of perspective in line with any sort of future movement in America? Can we sustain if that's the way we think about our past?
Well, no, because you lose the will to govern. The proposition that American government has always been bad is what leads you to sort of say, well, maybe the structures of government that we've always had are flawed. You can think of it being something as basic as policing, right? Policing is racist, so therefore we shouldn't police our cities anymore. American foreign policy is racist, so we shouldn't be involved in the broader world anymore. And so you have basically something that emasculates what is not just good or bad about America, but the isness of America. The fact that America is means it has to govern. And the modern left doesn't even want to do that. Look at California, right? So you don't have to go very far to see, okay, what does this proposition lead to?
Mm-hmm.
It leads to anarchy. So whether you like America or not, you should just want it to be. Because when it's not there, society breaks down.
Talking with Dr. Miles Smith, Assistant Professor of History here at Hillsdale College. His piece, Decline is a Choice. You have a few examples, comparisons, and perhaps lessons drawn from societies prior to the United States even existing, going back to the Roman Republic. What can we learn?
Well, Tacitus talks about basically the Republic sort of got weak and failed to govern itself. So someone's going to step into the vacuum, and the Caesars did. And that really revolutionized the life of Rome. And so he says at one point in the Annals that all at home was tranquil, and there were magistrates with the same titles. There was a younger generation sprung up since the victory at Actium, and even many of the older men had been born during the civil wars. How few were left who had seen the Republic. And so there's this idea that things changed so much that people kind of forgot what it was to have their old government, their old freedom, their old liberties. I don't think we're there yet, but you have to sort of at least ask yourself, what would it be like for an entire generation to go by and to have never experienced maybe what you and I grew up with? I think of maybe I probably idealized the 80s and 90s, but what would it be like for an entire generation, for example, to go without sort of being free-ranging? We're seeing this.
You say decline is a choice, and we need to be more forceful, acting more forcefully to ensure that transcendent moral beliefs remain. What does it look like in practical terms?
It looks like sort of saying something like, think about in Florida, the charge of book banning, for example. If I take a book, if I'm a state, I have the right to govern my state. A governor has the right to govern his state with his state legislature. And if they say, we're going to take pornographic books out of libraries, that's not book banning. You can still go buy that stuff on Amazon, but the fact that we're not putting it where a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old has immediate access to it isn't authoritarianism. That's not book banning. That's doing what governments have always done, doing what liberal governments, and by liberal I mean classical liberal governments, has always done. The same thing. Governments have a right to govern their state universities. None of this is authoritarian. And we may not like it, but the other option is that we sort of have a free-for-all that means a low-grade anarchy. And so most of what gets typed as quote-unquote authoritarian in the United States isn't really that authoritarian. Governments and state legislatures have the right to do that. It just looks like governing. It looks like what we would think of as government. I think of in the 90s, New York State,
mm-hmm.
New York City. Rudy Giuliani was not governing an autocracy or a theocracy, but he was pretty tough. He wanted to take smutty pictures of the Virgin Mary out of museums, and he was willing to use government to do that. So I don't think that going back to America in 1998 is an authoritarian proposition. Now, we can't go back, but we can govern again. And I think that's what you see some governors doing. That's like Ron DeSantis is a good example. Why is he popular in his own state? Because he governs it.
Dr. Miles Smith with us. Decline is a Choice is the piece in the Epoch Times. Final question. You said these Ivy League presidents and others are unaware that history can happen. Things can change on a permanent basis. Is there anything that you think perhaps history has happened to that is beyond the point of return, even if we do act more forcefully moving forward?
Some of it's the Internet. The way that what we call speech is litigated is going to be different. I think that it would be very difficult to police the internet in any way that doesn't create a sort of a state apparatus for governing it. So I think that is something that we're going to have to rethink what we think of as speech. Historically, people might say, well, I can shut a press down for X. Mm-hmm. Well, you were able to do that usually because you had some sort of social or legislative backing. It's a lot harder to do that on the internet without creating something that looks almost like a police state.
You can find this writing on the internet at the Epoch Times, EPOCH Times.com. Decline is a choice, an essay from Dr. Miles Smith, assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Paul Tice, his new book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history. It is with great honor and pride that we have been able to support several amazing local businesses like these over the years.
Thanks to the Redding Rancheria for their support of the Kiwanis Fiesta Dam Club Food for Kids program. We send 185 bags of food home every Friday. They're instrumental in helping us.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Hi friends, Tobacco and Brew here with a new cigar of the humidor. La Aroma de Cuba Pasión. Straight from the estate of Don Pepin Garcia comes this excellently crafted cigar. Profound notes of nougat, leather, molasses, and cedar please the palate throughout. La Aroma de Cuba Pasión. Be sure to get yours today. Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Hello, this is Rollin from the Flag Center. Are you thinking about a new flagpole for Memorial Day or 4th of July? Well, now is a good time. Currently, our high-quality Titan telescoping poles are on sale at prices too low to advertise. These beautiful silver or dark bronze poles are backed by a lifetime warranty and wind-rated at 95 miles per hour. The Flag Center, 2124 Hilltop Drive, since 1982.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Redding and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
This is Ted Lighty with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Lighty, and I'll see you at the range.
This is Carl Bott
and Ted Lighty.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. I'd like to thank everyone who came out for the annual Redding Rancheria Community Fund Dinner. Since its inception in 2002, the fund has granted over $4 million in support of our community. This year, we celebrated organizations who received grants. With your help, we raised over $50,000 for Redding Rancheria Community Fund, helping to continue the cycle of giving. the Redding Rancheria Community Fund Dinner, brought to you by this station and other proud sponsors.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to set up for an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and click on subscribe. We're joined now by Paul Tice. He spent 40 years working on Wall Street at some of the industry's most recognizable firms, specializing in the energy sector for most of his career. You perhaps have read him in op-ed pieces at the Wall Street Journal, The Examiner, and elsewhere. And now the recent book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Paul Tice, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Scott. It's good to be with you.
I appreciate the time. Let's get a definition out for people who perhaps aren't paying as close attention as others to what this is. ESG investing, what is it, and why should we be concerned or at least know more about it?
Sure. So ESG investing also synonymous with sustainable investing or responsible investing. But ESG factors are basically environmental, social, governance factors, which are non-financial metrics and also morally subjective. The argument is that ESG factors should be used to drive your company policy and your investment decision-making, as opposed to using objective financial metrics, you know, geared towards generating a financial return. And the whole ESG agenda is predicated on the theory of stakeholder capitalism, which says that companies should be run for the good of society, for people on the planet, as opposed to the owners of the company and the constituents that provide the capital or the employees. So it's not capitalism. It may be the end stage of capitalism if we don't reverse this thing over the next few years, but it's more accurately described as the government directing the private sector, working through third-party intermediaries led by the United Nations and a network of NGOs. And the better description of that would be fascism.
Paul Tice is with us. His book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. You say in the book, sustainable investing sets up as a kind of self-assembly Trojan horse kit for the financial industry. What do you mean by that? What are they trying to sneak in?
Well, if you look over the last 15 years, really since the global financial crisis in 2008, ESG and sustainable investing has made great inroads into the financial industry. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. You know, first and foremost, coming out of the 2008 crisis, Wall Street needed to work on its image. They were being blamed for wrecking Main Street somewhat unfairly. I think government had a big hand in what happened in 08. But they needed to burnish their image. And then ESG comes along, and the virtue signaling aspect of ESG can't be underestimated. So it suckered a lot of people in the industry to join on board. And there's, you know, one leading group in the industry led by the United Nations. It's the Principles for Responsible Investment. It was set up in 2006, and right now every Wall Street firm is a member of that UN-led group. And membership in that group has requirements, and one of them is to integrate ESG into all of your assets that you manage, you know, not just sustainable funds that were raised with that specific purpose. They want you to integrate ESG into all of the assets that you had, even legacy funds, and that's obviously a fiduciary problem. So I think the first phase of ESG has been through moral suasion that people have been, again, suckered into the trade. Right now it's tough to find the exit, and the problem that's coming between now and 2030 is that regulations, both here as well as in Europe in particular, are now going to cement this whole agenda into place.
Your second chapter is, it's all about climate change and arguing that controlling the energy sector means that they, the left or those behind ESG, could also control the entire global economy. How does ESG, in their mind, help make that a reality?
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I focus on a lot in the book, given my background of working with the energy industry through most of my career. There's been a lot of focus on some of the more cultural issues, some of the woke capitalist aspects, what's going on in corporate boardrooms. not to minimize any of those issues, but I think ESG, the main focus needs to remain on climate change, because that is what everyone agrees is the number one priority ESG goal. And ESG investing is closely intertwined with sustainable development and climate change, which are also two United Nations-led programs. So ESG is basically the funding or defunding piece of the climate agenda. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind. But basically, it's going to be used to defund oil and gas and direct capital towards, you know, more approved industries, starting with clean energy. So that's going to be that's the first and foremost priority. After that is accomplished over the coming years, then, you know, the movement will figure out exactly what the next phase is, because climate change is the core that everyone agrees on. You know, besides that, ESG is kind of a collection of progressive wants that don't really hang together very well.
Paul Tice with us, the book The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Your last chapter is a 2030 exit plan to perhaps avoid some of these consequences. How do we get ourselves out of this mess?
Yeah, and then, you know, despite the, the subtitle being a little ominous, you know, I approach writing the book kind of like a Christmas carol where, you know, this is the ghost of Christmas yet to come unless we change our ways. So the first step in solving a problem is to kind of acknowledge the scope and the depth of the problem, and that'll dictate tactics. So that was the whole point of the book, as well as to give a voice to all the people working in Wall Street that also disagree with ESG but, you know, are unable to speak out publicly. So what we need to do really is, as I mentioned, the regulations are now coming down in this country, particularly over in Europe, and that's going to cement this whole agenda in place. And then it's not going to matter if you have a BlackRock or another firm that either believes in it or doesn't, because there are a lot of firms out there just doing this because they don't want to be singled out and targeted for stepping out of line. So we need to recognize that dynamic. So we really have to go after the regulations that are coming. So we really need to push back. I think that pushback will require government resources because of how well developed the regulatory complex is right now and how effective progressives have used the judicial system to kind of get their way on ESG and climate change. And we should acknowledge that this has not been a democratic process. It's never been, you know, a referendum. So a lot of this agenda has been implemented behind the scenes through what I would argue is extra-legal means. So we need to use government resources. I think Republicans at the state level really need to lead the charge, because at the federal level, it's been less than effective, to be kind. But I think the red states, where they have a vested interest and maybe a domestic oil and gas industry that's being threatened, at least that aligns their interest to do something. And we've seen the beginnings of that with West Virginia versus EPA. I would use the same exact logic around that precedent to go after all these financial regulations that are coming. So being able to speak out more in public, there'll be strength in numbers, and I think that'll give some backbone to some of the lawmakers that we need right now to lead the charge.
Paul Tice, the book is The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Paul, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Up next, we talk with Jason Peters from Hillsdale's English Department. He'll introduce us to Wendell Berry. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Everybody has been dealing with the availability of homeowners insurance in Northern California. Companies not writing your home insurance anymore are leaving the state altogether. Siskiyou Insurance has hired a specialist specifically for dealing with a homeowners crisis here in Shasta County. He specializes in what the market is doing, coverages, and which companies may be able to help. Call Brian Dews at Siskiyou Insurance Services for your home or auto consultation. Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Life is always easier when we make good decisions. Taking care of your vehicle with regular maintenance is a smart decision that will save you money. Going to Premier Oil Change for regular maintenance is another great decision and an easy way to maintain your new car warranty. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Come experience fast drive-through service with no appointment required. Premier changes your fluids while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car. Enjoy a free beverage and free Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point service. Don't forget that you can earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palisadro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Redding on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park. And in Anderson, across from Roundtable, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier, your friendly oil change.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Experience luxurious bliss with Pinnacle Cultivators, Redding's premier licensed legacy cultivator exclusively at the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake. Pinnacle's carefully crafted, expertly curated flower guarantees an exceptional experience with rare genetics and distinctive flavors, freshly packaged daily for a genuine farm-to-table experience. Visit 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-276-9771 for delivery and hours of operation. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragon.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Redding has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X, formerly Twitter. We're at Hillsdale Radio for show updates and guest information. We're joined by Dr. Jason Peters. He is Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Peters, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
Beginning a multi-part conversation about the American author and writer Wendell Berry, one of our great living writers here in the United States. In our first conversation here, we give you a little background, some biographical detail. What should we know about Wendell Berry? Tell us first about his farm. It's a big part of what we'll be talking about in the future about Wendell Berry and his family history down in Kentucky.
Long history of farming in Kentucky. He's got a hillside farm there in his home county, which doesn't conduce to crops really, but to grazing, and he keeps the ground covered well for his livestock there. But his father was a farmer and a lawyer, and his grandfather was a farmer, and he is, as by his own definition, a man born to farming. It's a line from one of his poems. And he says that he has farmed as a writer and written as a farmer, and that being a farmer informs his writing, being a writer informs his farming, because these are analogous enterprises. They both have to respect form. They both have to respect limits, and they both have to be done by great care for artistry. And if you ever happen upon his farm in Kentucky, you'll see a place very well cared for, mm-hmm. a place where you would want to be and maybe not want to leave, as he says now. He's getting up there in age, and he doesn't want to leave home very much, and doesn't. But he comes from a long history of family farming, and he's passionately devoted to the practice of farming.
As a young man, he lived in California, he lived in New York City, the UK. He was a professor at NYU and the University of Kentucky. He could have left. He could have gone elsewhere. He could have stayed outside of Kentucky. What brought him back to that Kentucky farm?
What brought him back was his love for farming. He left in after finishing an MA in English at Kentucky. He went to Stanford as a fellow in the Wallace Stegner creative writing program. Was out there for a couple of years, taught a little bit out there. He wrote his book, The Hidden Wound, while he was out there. And then he won a Guggenheim Fellowship in the early 60s and was in the south of France mostly and in Italy during that time. And when he came back, he took a job as the director of writing at the University of New York in the Bronx, I think it was, and was there for about 4 years. And he missed the farm. He missed being around animals. I think he probably didn't like big city life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just decided that he was going to go back to the farm, back to Kentucky, and figure out a way to make it work. And all of his friends in New York said to him, if you do this, you're never going to be a writer, because, you know, only the big city is worth writing about, and writers are city-dwelling people. So they said, if you do this, you're never going to be a writer. And if you discount the 50 books he wrote since then, I guess they were right. But he bought this rundown hillside farm, and even his dad said to him, this is not a great piece of land, but I think he was just stubborn enough to say that he could make it work. But the fact of the matter is, I think he's not a university man. He's not an institutional man. I don't think he likes being told what to do by committees who don't know up from down. Mm. And he just had a deep love for the farm life. And so he went back in 1964, I guess it was. And he did have some teaching gigs to help supplement the enterprise there, in particular teaching at the University of Kentucky for a while and at other places as well, until he could finally make a living farming and, I think, doing some speaking gigs. And I don't know what the royalties in the books ever did for him. Not much, I suppose. Like a lot of us, I think he just had to be outdoors, and there was no place to be in a real outdoors in New York City.
Talking with Dr. Jason Peters about Wendell Berry, how does he come to his traditional value structure, his reference for agrarian values, his thoughts on marital fidelity, strong communities being essential for the survival and well-being of the planet? How does that come to him through his life?
He was introduced to the Southern agrarians when he was in college by one of his professors, and in particular, the book I'll Take My Stand. And he wasn't really even familiar with the word agrarian, or that there were such people who are agrarians, until reading that book. And he was, I think, very profoundly affected by the introductory piece by John Crow Ransom, who was one of the two editors of that volume. And Ransom had used the word, he had pitted agrarian economy against industrial economy, and those became important categories of thought for Berry. But I think he was really affected by his father's care, his father's love of his community, and his father's concern that farmers be properly cared for, respected, and treated in an economy and in under government policy that was increasingly inimical to their ways of life. And when he moved back, he saw how, when he moved back to Kentucky, he saw how threatened that community was and how threatened all rural communities were. And it became a kind of lifelong mission of his, vocation of his, to defend rural communities and defend small farmers. And he's been doing that really even ever since, of course, the publication in 1977 of The Unsettling of America, but even before that in earlier books and essays.
If you read some of Barry, you're likely to come across this place of Port William. It's a fictional town that is the setting for many of his stories. What's the makeup of this town where many of his novels and short stories are set?
Port William was the name originally for the town that is now Carrollton, Kentucky, and that is where the Kentucky River empties into the Ohio River. Barry lives in a place called Port Royal, which is upriver, I'm going to say, maybe 10 miles. And he took the name Port William for this farming community, which is interestingly populated. There are good people in it. There are derelicts in it. There are people who care for one another and for the place. And there are people who are drunks and murderers and liars. But it's the world that Barry seems to find most interesting. If you read, for example, Andy Catlett, Early Travels, which is a later, a kind of a later novel that's set early in the time frame that his characters appear. You see a young boy, Andy Catlett, is kind of the autobiographical character. He shares many similarities with Barry himself. But this young boy, he finds that the world of horses and of horse-drawn implements and of life moving at a slower, non-mechanical pace to be more real than the one that he is growing into after the Second World War. That world seems to him to be all props and scenery and artificial, and the real life is the life of these characters who live close to the weather and are contingent upon nature's vicissitudes. And so I think impetus for his setting his fiction mostly in Port William is his deep love for this older way of life that he grew up in but was disappearing very quickly when he was a young boy.
Dr. Jason Peters with us talking about Wendell Berry. We'll pause right there, come back and talk about one of his seminal works, The Unsettling of America. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The Shasta College summer term will start June 10th, and priority registration has started. Contact a counselor and check out all the cool classes being offered this summer. Get a jump start on a degree or certificate, or get transfer ready by taking one of the many classes held this summer at Shasta College. Go to www.shastacollege.edu/admissions to get started. Reading, when was the last time you experienced Black Bear Diner? Entrepreneur Magazine recently recognized this hometown diner as a top growing national restaurant. Why? Because there's always plenty for your paws. With delicious homestyle options that deliver choice, value, variety, and a cozy way to make memories and celebrate occasions. Come on in and remind yourself what guests all over the country are discovering.
Black Bear Diner.
Tired of that long drive home from Sacramento? Try Redding Regional Airport, where you can travel the world with one connection on United, Alaska, or Avelo Airlines. RDD is located just down the road. Skip the drive, enjoy quick check-ins, and travel with ease and convenience. Getting where you want to go is easier than ever with non-stop flights to San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Burbank. Enjoy that vacation you've been dreaming about. Fly with ease and convenience from Redding Regional Airport.
Attention adventure seekers. Save the date for the 30th annual Safari Club International Banquet hosted by the Redding Chapter of Safari Club International on April 27th at the Wind River Resort Center beginning at 5 p.m. Immerse yourself in the thrill of our auction featuring guns, hunting trips, equipment, and breathtaking artwork. Get ready for games and a drawing with fantastic prizes. For more details and tickets, visit sciredding.org. Join us for an unforgettable evening of camaraderie and conversation. See you there.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your host, Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Dr. Jason Peters, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, about Wendell Berry, and more specifically now, about the unsettling of America. Dr. Peters, why does Berry think that agriculture is the foundation of America's greater culture?
The simple answer to that is you can talk all you want about anything you want to talk about, but if you're not eating, you're not going to be talking about it for very long. And you're not going to be eating for very long if you are committed to a way of life that destroys the sources that we live from. The Unsettling of America is a book that grew out of an interesting little episode in Berry's life. He was the president of the Sierra Club Cumberland chapter when it was revealed that the Sierra Club had some investments in some nefarious businesses. And this set him off. He was really kind of hacked off about this. And so he, you know, what happened was he discovered that there were all these people who claimed to be environmentalists who didn't know anything about farming and didn't know anything about the proper care of the land. And so The Unsettling was a book in which he set out to, I think, teach environmentalists something fundamental, which is to say, how we work by nature's law of return. Things grow, they die. When they die, they're turned back into life by a process called decomposition. So The Unsettling was an attempt on Berry's part to understand what was going wrong in American agriculture after the Second World War.
What did he see as the harmful consequences of U.S. agriculture policy, and how much of that has perhaps come to fruition over the past 40-plus years or so?
So take, for example, his grandfather, as he says somewhere, was loved farm animals. He loved draft animals. He was passionately devoted to animal traction in farming. He intuited, rightly, right from the start, that tractors were going to compact the soil. And, of course, they do. I think he was worried about all sorts of things, chief among them topsoil loss, mm-hmm. which occurs when you are committed to, as we are now, to annual monocultures, corn and soybean in particular. So the problems that he identified soil compaction, soil loss, are of one sort. There are others, of course, and this has to do with the health of small towns and small rural farming communities. I think maybe a good way to put this would be to say that after the Second World War, when we saw this migration from the farm to the cities, two things happened. First, the people left the land, and secondly, the land left the land. And what I mean by that is the topsoil left. And particularly for a couple of reasons, the methods of farming with expensive, heavy equipment, but also because there just were too few people on the land to keep watch over it. And he pointed out back in the 1970s, this was before the unsettling of America, he pointed out that what we were doing really was we were exporting our topsoil to keep our tractors running. And what he meant by that was we're overproducing so that we can afford to import foreign oil to keep those tractors running. And all we had to do to do that was to export our topsoil, which was to send it to the waterways and down to the Gulf of Mexico. And it was a really, I thought, interesting way of putting the problem. But that's kind of what it looked like for him in the 1970s when he went to work on this.
Talking with Dr. Jason Peters about Wendell Berry and his work, The Unsettling of America here, you delved into this a little bit in your description of Berry's observations on land treatment. We're going to protect this over here, but here we're going to abuse, in a sense. How does he explain and see this conflict between contrasting character in America, between the exploitative nature and the nurturing nature of America?
He adopted the language of his teacher, Wallace Stegner, who said that Americans can be divided into two groups, the boomers and the stickers. The boomers are those who will use up a place and move on to the next spot until they use up that place and then keep moving on. Turns out there is a limit to westward expansion. It's called the Pacific Ocean. And at that point, you've got nowhere to go. And by contrast, there are the stickers. And those are the people who say, we're going to settle here and take care of the place well. If you think about it this way, I think you can say with some confidence that the exploitive impulse in American life is characterized by mobility. We tend to think that mobility is a good thing. We want people to be mobile. I don't know who the we in that sentence is, but you can't really care well for a place if you're not there long enough to care that its health continues. And I think the part of the problem that he identifies is that we are all too willing to be on the move and never willing enough to stay put, never willing enough to be at home. And Berry has suggested that our attitude toward young people and our attitude toward education is essentially the same as the strip miners. We take kids from one place, we educate them in another, and we send them off somewhere else to be boomers, not stickers. We don't educate them to go back home. And it's interesting to see the looks on the faces of some students when you say to them, you know, when you get done here, you can go back home and you can pay your debts to the people that you have debts to, who got you here in the first place. And you can be a part of preserving the places that you came from instead of being the person who says, you know, last man out, you know, hit the lights.
One final question here, more taking into account his entire body of work. When you read from one project next in Berry's books and short stories, the writing style can vary wildly. Are his greatest strengths as a writer this versatility and authenticity? Because no matter what it always is Berry.
Great question. His fiction has quite a bit of variety in it, I think. excuse me. The early story, the early novels are different from the later novels in one particular way. And that is, you sometimes feel in the later novels that you're reading an essayist writing a novel, whereas in the early novels you don't so much, but that's because Barry hadn't really established himself as a kind of polemic essayist. I don't know what it would be like to read Hannah Coulter or what it would be like to read Jaber Crow if you had never read the essays. Because I've read the essays and I can hear repeat passages and sentiments and whatnot. So I tend to prefer some of the earlier work. But you're right, he can be very serious-minded and very careful with his language in the essays, and he can also be a little snarky, and he can be a little ironic, satiric, I guess maybe is the better word. But he does have the capacity to speak plainly.
Mm-hmm.
I keep coming back to this idea: why would you explain somebody who's already so clear in the first place? Very plain-speaking essayist, a good storyteller, very funny storyteller. And as a poet, he's especially a plain-speaking writer. I think it is a strength of his that he can do very well as an essayist, a novelist, and a poet. And don't forget that he wrote at least one biography that was of Harlan Hubbard.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that he is an essayist first, and then whether he's a poet or a fiction writer second or third, I guess I'm not prepared to say.
Dr. Jason Peters, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, as we begin our multi-part conversation about the work and life of Wendell Berry. Dr. Peters, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're welcome.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Miles Smith from Hillsdale's History Department, Paul Tice, his new book, The Race to Zero, and Dr. Jason Peters from Hillsdale's English Department. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including with Paul Tice this week, on the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Here at KCNR Radio, we are fortunate to have two well-informed citizens.
Hi, I'm Nick Gardner.
And I'm Doug Janke, and we'll give you the inside scoop of news affecting you.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest, Sundays, here, 8 o'clock.
KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and on your AM dial, 1460.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.